Welcome to the Citizens for Health radio show on Building Fortunes Radio with your hosts Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Make sure you check us out by clicking on the Citizens for Health radio show link on buildingfortunesradio.com. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. The Citizens for Health Education Foundation offers tools to inform the public of health issues and educate and influence policymakers. Jim Turner is here to spread the word about some of the most interesting topics that can affect your world, from the dangers of mislabeled or dangerous products to the questions and concerns of vaccines. You'll want to listen to Jim as he speaks on behalf of Citizens for Health. And now, on to our show with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Take it away, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. For those people that like us to date, if you will, the time and whatever of when we're doing our radio shows today is July 30th, 2021. I had to look at a calendar because sometimes I'm off. So July 30th of 2021, it's noon, and every Friday at noon, when we get a chance to, we do a radio show with Jim Turner. Jim is one of the original founders, close to the original founders of Citizens for Health. They have a great website, citizens.org, citizens.org. You got to sign up for the newsletter. They have some great action alerts and great information on that radio show, on that website. But a while back, I had met Jim as a result of some things that I was doing in home-based businesses, and I realized that he was a very smart gentleman, and he was a really good guy, and we just started a radio show, and I said, you know, I'd love to have you here if you could host a radio show, and from the very beginning, we've been doing this radio show on Fridays. Now, I dated today's as far as we do it every Friday at noon, whenever he's in town and available, and, you know, stuff like that goes on. Sometimes if I'm away, we probably make more of the live radio shows than we do replays lately. But I have learned so much from Jim Turner, and if I've learned so much from Jim Turner, I'm going to bet, I'll make the presumption or assumption that you and the people that are important to you will probably learn a lot as well. There's a lot. I mean, I could go through a lot of things. So to be specific, you know, we've spoken about vaccines and masks and political events and political views and the political procedures and tobacco and advertising and newspapers and media and social media and all these things. I mean, I could go over about smart meters on, you know, the outside of your house or dental fillings, or we could talk about homeopathy, and we've spoken about all different kinds of things, acupuncture needles, and Jim Turner's a wealth of information, and I don't want to sound selfish, but I've learned so much, probably more than all of our listeners, only because I am the guest host on these radio shows. So I'm kind of involved in all these things, and I get a chance to think about it all week long prior to a radio show and then after a radio show, some of the things that he said. So the reason why I mentioned that, if you go to buildingfortunesradio.com/citizens, buildingfortunesradio.com/citizens, you can pick up on any, and I mean any radio show and listen to it even out of order, because there's some wonderful lessons in there. So Jim's an attorney. He's over in Washington, D.C. We've all kind of watched the pivot of the shift, if you will, through the COVID thing as we've been doing this, and we're watching the evolution of the COVID thing as we continue, as we've learned a lot more about stuff that we probably wouldn't have learned about, and we'll talk about some of those things as we get started. But Jim, thanks for being here on your own radio show.
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate it. I like doing the shows, and they're very helpful for me. I learn a lot as well. I think probably we learn a lot because we're not as smart as the audience for the most part. Maybe we have some facts that they need to know about that we have that we found and we can share. But generally speaking, I find people who are living their lives on a day-to-day basis have an awful lot of capacity that they use that gets overlooked by people who end up being on the radio or in any other media. And we started this, I think, in 2014, as I recall, doing these Friday shows. And, you know, and when you say in town, it's Washington. I'm at one of those strange beasts called a Washington lawyer. I've been here since 1968 and working away on various kinds of issues. And most people just live their lives and are not, you know, terribly interested in the kind of things that we talk about policy-wise, because they're trying to live their lives and so forth. And what I try to do, I wanted to pick up on what you were saying. I start out as a lawyer, and then I add the consumer lawyer part to it, because I think if you look at the world from the standpoint of the individual, living on a day-to-day basis and saying, what is there to help me make the decisions I want to make and come up with the answers I want to come up with? And you look at the world from that angle, all kinds of things that seem nonsensical when you look at them as public policy for, suddenly you can see the kind of decisions that you need to make and look for the kind of information you need to make those decisions. And that's what I've been doing for the last 50 years or so, since I started here in 68 with Ralph Nader. I was one of the first Ralph Nader Raiders and studied the worked on the FDA. Started then in 68, worked on the FDA, and continue to do that right now. And, here we are with the FDA right in the middle of several of the biggest issues going on in society. And I think that the people out there who are making decisions, and listening to us, are very capable of making decisions on their own behalf as long as they have information that will help them do that. And I'm not even sure, if you got all the information, some people with the information will make a different decision than others, and I think that's totally reasonable. So just wanted to get on the record that, you and I are trying to help get people get information, but they're the smart ones that know how to use it once they have it. And we look forward to having more and more of this going out.
Yeah, I'm all about, I know you've said it many times, individual choice. Like, give yourself the choice. Your situation is probably different than anybody else's, maybe, depending on the situation or the scenario we paint this to. But I want to be able to have a choice. So whether it's vaccines or nutrition or whatever, my lifestyle, I would like to have the choice. And as long as they're not hurting anybody else, I think I should deserve that. Now, not like a Ross Ulbricht, if you remember the Silk Road guy, who went to the extent of actually making, buying drugs and handguns and whatever, anything else between two consenting adults possible. That was a little bit to the extreme, and he's paying the ultimate penalty for that. But, realistically, if I want to wear a mask or not, or take a vaccine or not, or give one to my kids or my dog or my pet llama, I want to be able to make some of those decisions on my own as long as they're not impacting other people. And I know that's where maybe some people start to draw the line. But we could talk about whatever you want to talk about. I know the mask thing is a big thing. The vaccine thing, of course, is a big thing. And as this is starting to shake out, there's probably more confusion than when we got started. So I'll let you start off wherever we want to start off.
Well, you had mentioned the mask mandate or the mask issue as one of importance. Why don't you just sketch out for me what you think is important about the mask question, and I'll tell you what I think is important.
Well, from the first part, the business part of me, from the very beginning, said masks, the way we're doing masks, aren't going to work. Obviously, people can make masks, or manufacturers could make masks that would work, and people would probably need to be trained on how to use it, but the two issues that I just brought up, the type of mask and the way it's implemented, were probably going to mean there are some failure points. And whether you're designing a bridge or a building or a business, you're looking for the failure points and you'd realize this isn't going to work. And there you go. That's enough of the my mask conversation. So would they help? A little bit, sure. Do they help psychologically? Maybe a little bit. But there's a lot of downside to that, and we're still facing the same argument. Today, an obvious thing, for anybody, can't even discuss it, is masks are not going to do the whole job. And the reality is that we are now divided in houses, the Senate versus the House of Representatives, on whether they can or can't wear their masks. And this is absolutely crazier. Whether you can or can't send your kids to school, go into a building, maybe even start to go into a store, or, a sporting event or anything else like that, or we can continue. It's just all over the place. Entertainment, bars or concerts or stuff like that. So the idea that we're still having this issue is just crazy. And the conflict, obvious conflict of herd immunity, people have gotten sick and therefore should be probably the best to be able to handle any other minimal exposure. And then also the idea of vaccines. These things are supposed to be able to protect us. Why are we still having the same crazy lockdown kind of almost, you're going to lose your job as a federal worker argument if you're not either masking up with one that might eat, we're not telling you which mask, but we're just saying mask up, put some kind of a face covering on it, And the reality is that, and then also the idea that you're going to have these tests all the time. So that's where I want to go with this. Why are we still having this conversation? And why, you know, I kind of guess why, but the reality is why are we still having this conversation and this conflict?
Well, the conversation that we're having on vaccines, masks, and so forth is a very similar to the conversation that we're having on pretty much all the systems that we have going in our culture right now. They're all under the same kind of pressure. It can be the criminal justice system, the prisons, education, healthcare. They're all under horrible pressure. And they're, I think, under that pressure, my fundamental sense that the reason they're under that kind of pressure, the systems are under that kind of pressure, that they're not responding, is because for the most part they've been designed from the standpoint of the producer of whatever that system's about, so that the system has been less designed to provide the optimum health for the individual who is a patient or a client or a end user of that system, but designed more for how the system itself and the people who own the system and who are paid by the system can work together to create an outcome which is less than optimum, but is better than if you just let everybody run about on their own. What I'm saying is that the individual is often, I think, almost always put at the end of the line as to reasons why we do a system. In the case of the vaccine world, it's and the mask world, all of those, this has been addressed as a public health problem. And a public health problem always trades off the benefits of the total group against the benefits of any individuals. So if you press the vaccine people, the pro-vax people hard enough, they will say that it's all right that a few people die from the vaccine because it's going to save the whole community. But that's not the trade-off that you want to have. The trade-off you want to have is how do we create a way so that everybody in the community has an opportunity to actually survive and prosper. And the biggest issue here is that the people who are going to succumb to whatever are going to succumb whether there's a program or not. I mean I don't mean that there was no program, that they're going to die anyway or they're going to be harmed anyway. But when you release into the culture the concept of an agent that's going to go out there and kill people that it runs into, how you respond to that agent is very, very important. And you need to say to yourself, well, I've got something here that can save 90% of the people, but we're going to lose 5% of them or 1% of them, whatever. That's a trade-off that needs to be looked at in and of itself, because the 1% that may be traded off, or the 0.1%, or the one person, has value and rights and should be in a position to be allowed to make their own choices. And how we create a system to do that is the challenge. I think the American system is closer to coming up with how the people can be protected to making those decisions than most of the systems throughout history, but it still is not there. And the thing that troubles me most about something like the mask mandates or even the vaccine mandates that are moving along is that the government is stepping aside and telling the industries across the country to put these rules in place for their workplace. They're leaving it open as something of a choice for the industries, but they're having the industries, they're pressuring the industries to say, wear a mask, get vaccinated, and so forth. And that creates a situation where there's nobody, there's no mechanism for individuals to say, wait a minute, I don't want to do that. How can we set up a system where I don't have to do that? Several groups of nurses across the country have either had to quit or been fired because they won't wear, take the vaccine to work in a hospital. That's a self-defeating activity for the society. If increasingly people who are on the front lines begin to say, wait a minute, I'm very nervous about this, I don't want to take it, and they start disappearing from the front lines could get very thin. We need to have a process for making these decisions And we have not got that going right now. And I think that's a very serious problem. And I think I mentioned on this program several times in the past that I started looking at the vaccine issue in 1970 to 1980 with a group of individuals inside the government and outside, both, and some in industry as well, who were quite concerned about the way vaccines were regulated at that period. And we did a lot of work, and we got them moved over to the FDA, and we got standards set in place and said, here's how they should be regulated, and this will help us in the future when we have to make decisions. There are two things about that experience of mine that are very relevant to me in the current situation, and I think are useful to understand where we are. First of all, in 1976, there was an effort to create a nationwide vaccination against what was then called the swine flu. And that particular outbreak is still called the first swine flu, or, you know, the modern swine flu outbreak, 1976. Then there was a later one or two. So 1976, we had all this stuff in place about moving regulation to the FDA and creating a sounder set of public policies and so forth. And the result of that was that the effort of the government to inoculate 200 million people came to an end about 49 million people because of the number of side effects and deaths and so forth that were going on from the vaccine itself. If we had not been in place at that point, if in other words, the way that vaccines were regulated in 1970 had not been changed, we would have had in 1976 what we're having now, a worldwide pandemic of something that was out of control, couldn't be dealt with, that was all those arguments were made then about that swine flu. And there are scientific reasons why that was a correct analysis in terms of what was going on, but we were able to handle it without the kind of chaos that we are currently having. So that's one of the main points that I took away from that. In addition to that, I'm quite concerned that from then on, from 1980 on, we began to lay out the framework for what came to be the value and rules and principles that are involved here in 2021. The problem is that the FDA system that was put in place back in the 70s has been passed by. It's gone around. All these vaccines that are on the market right now are on the market under emergency rules, and basically none of them have gone through the safety processes and so forth that were set up. And the result of that is that we're back in the same kind of bad regulation that was being done in 1970. The thing that we got asked to get involved in at the Nader place, and then I got involved in more details and worked out a new system. That the system that was put in place at that point has been completely bypassed at this point. And we need to know why that happened. We need to understand what's happening. These are going to keep coming. There were about three of them during the Obama administration, and they were handled using the proper rules. 2020, we ended up bypassing all the rules. And my sense as a lawyer, I believe that the rules are really, really important, even in an extremist situation. And in the rules, if you have extremists, you have to still go through a process. And it's laid out in the law. You say, you know, what can the state do to step in and solve this problem? Is the thing they're proposing the best way to do it, and is it the least intrusive? And that's a process. And if it's speeded up, it could do a whole lot of stuff. But right now, we've got ourselves in a mess where we don't have any systematic way to make these decisions. And so what the government is doing in order to respond to that is deferring over to industry. And they're saying to the job people who supply jobs, make your folks do the right thing. We're putting it on you, because if you don't, then the society is going to have a very, very serious problem. They may be right, given the mess that's gone on for the last 5 or 6 years in the vaccine regulation world. They may be right that where we are, maybe we have to do something that's less than optimum. But we have to understand we're going to have more and more and more of these. They're going to keep coming. The idea that we're going to go back to normal, I think, is just a mistake. I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have to come up with a new normal and define how we're going to be living going forward, given that we've now got, you know, Delta out there creating the Delta variation, creating trouble. We've got Lambda coming along. There are 3,200 viruses in a bat. Let's say they came from a bat or they're related to something that comes from a bat. All of them can mutate or create variants. They're all novel. This is not going to be handled effectively. That what's coming down the pike is not going to be handled effectively using the tools that we've used up until now. So I just put that out there as something to think about. And my urging is to seriously look at this from the standpoint of the ultimate individual, the individual consumer, giving them the maximum amount of choice that they can be given, because that choice, those choices, those in our case, you know, 360 million and worldwide 6.8 billion choices that are being made, that can be made, the broadest amount of choice that can be made and accepted by the society will give us, in the long run, the best resolution of the issue, the best outcome, the best answer. That's the democratic principle. It's mathematical. You can put it on computer programs. You will see that a dispersed decision-making system is going to give you a much richer, deeper, broader decision than a top-down giving orders system will give you. How we get there is what the task is that we face as a society and as individuals in a society, and in this case, in a democratic republic. We're in a society that makes these decisions democratically. So I just put that out there as a context for the conversation. In that situation, anybody that wants to wear a mask anywhere should be allowed to wear a mask. Whether they can be stopped from wearing a mask or not is a tougher question, but still, the reason it's tougher is because not wearing a mask isn't going to harm the community. If people want to go wear masks, it's not going to harm the community that somebody wore a mask. On the other hand, if you don't wear a mask, you could harm the community. And that's where the issue becomes something that has to be dealt with as a collective issue rather than an individual issue. And so we need to make it very, very clear. How do masks get used by the whole society? When it comes to vaccination, we have a different problem altogether. You're now piercing the bodily integrity, and the value the barriers to that are very, very high, and they have to be done very, very carefully. And we've not been very careful about that in the system we're in right now. I'll stop there, Peter.
Great information. Well, you know, there's so many things about this. I'm going to just jump into the vaccines just for an example, and I'll kind of throw a word salad together, and you can kind of pick it out from here. I'm looking at people and their reactions and their thought patterns and what they're saying. So I'll be specific. I look at some people and I say, you know what, these people are emotionally deranged, some of them, or they're so solid in their belief, their conviction is blinding. So I look at sometimes, you know, doctors or politicians or regular people, the vaccine. And you know, and then I come always to the point that you make, which is, you know, which one? You know, there's 93 of them. There's probably 3 or 4 or 5 that are available to you. Which one are you talking about, the vaccine? Because they're all kind of different. So when they push the generic, the vaccine, I kind of think that maybe they're a little bit blinded by their derangement. But then I start to look, and I remember on some radio shows that I've made with you, or that, you know, we've done together, and I made a comment about polio and a vaccine, or smallpox and a vaccine, you would make a comment something along the line of, well, that's not exactly how it went, Peter. And, you know, we never jumped into it, but I started to, like, that threw my radar up. What don't I know about polio that Jim would say that? Because, you know, we've always been told, quote unquote, you know, if you just follow the narrative that, you know, smallpox was eradicated by vaccines and polio has been eradicated by vaccines and all these other types of things, vaccines have been safe and effective. So I really started to dig, and the more I dig, the more concerns that I really have. And I sent you a movie. It was on a platform that Mike Adams put together called brighteon.com. Now, I got to give you the little warning. Mike Adams has really great ideas and then equally opposite fringe ideas sometimes. So he, I don't know about him. He's just a weird in a positive, negative way guy where he saw his YouTube channel shut down. And he says, I'm going to create a platform for people to be able to put up YouTube videos or the equivalent of YouTube videos. So that's where Brighteon comes from. So you'll see a whole bunch of crazy stuff if you go there. Anyway, there was one called something like the history of vaccines or the long history of vaccines. And I forgot the title specifically, but I started to watch it and that was my little wind up for smallpox. And when I started to watch about smallpox, I would see that, you know, smallpox started this way, but a lot of the people that took the smallpox or were given the smallpox vaccine died of smallpox. And, you know, the rulers of the world were pushing smallpox, and they were making it, like, mandatory that you get this vaccination. And then, but people were dying. And then it stopped for a little bit because so many people were dying, and somebody came up again, which started to push it again. And this is all before the 1900s. And they started pushing again, and people were going to jail because they wouldn't take the smallpox vaccine, and people were being fined because they wouldn't take the smallpox vaccine, and people were being fired because they wouldn't take the smallpox vaccine, and it was just like deja vu all over again. Just take 1700 or 1800 or 1900 and replace it with 2021, and it was like, this is just, what is the pattern here? Like, something's the vaccine, and then they went through a lot of other things. A two-hour movie. It was a great movie, well put together, stuff I've never seen before. Stuff I think everybody needs to see, whether you agree with it or not, is totally up to you. But the reality was it was so thought-provoking. I said to myself, who really watches this? Who really gets a chance to study this stuff? Was this available? Here's my long, winding story wounding down. You know, did my grandfather ever have access to this information? No, he was a bricklayer. He could have never given me, his grandson, this information. How about my mom and my dad? Did they have access to this information? No, not really. They were just two people raising five children, you know, and worked. My mom worked three jobs, my dad worked two, and had a little sister that was born mentally retarded. So they didn't have any time to do this stuff. And where was this information? It was at the library. Who in my family could have taught me this? And the answer is nobody. I, meaning Peter Mingles, my age, this limited time frame, meaning this past decade, was the only one that had this types of information easily accessible. And now that it's and I'm an exception because I get a chance to have more computer time than most people do, but Jim, nobody, almost nobody, except for those niche groups, maybe like you and me and a few others, are really have ever had access to this type of information before. So it was worked, basically we were working on the narrative that we were told. Smallpox vaccine worked, and it eradicated the disease. And if it comes back, we're going to have to do vaccines all over again. But the stuff that I saw was very different than what I've been taught in school, if you will, or taught on the news. And that was really scary, especially when you say, well, what about now? They're saying the same thing. They're saying the same things that they were saying way back then or similar things. And I'm like, what is going, you know, I know what's going on, but the reality is this is really, really weird, kind of dangerous. So I'm done with my little rambling story.
Yeah. Well, here's my reaction to that. First of all, I suspect that many people, many more than we would ever imagine, are aware of the dangers that are presented in the trade-off between getting the smallpox vaccine and not. When I say they're aware of it, I'm not sure they're necessarily consciously aware of it, but there is a very strong tendency to say, wait a minute, I'm really not sure I want this thing stuck in my arm, whatever it is. And then from that, they start to develop their thinking. I noticed several years ago, the man who was a public health doctor who was credited with eradicating smallpox from the world, a big program of the United Nations and the health across the world, and they announced their success in doing this in the 80s. But one of the things that was in this story about he had died, I think, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. One of the things in the story in the front page of the Washington Post was that vaccinations did not play a huge role in that effort to eradicate smallpox from the world. What they used was something called targeted vaccination. They very carefully figured out which populations being vaccinated would help eradicate smallpox itself. But there were many, many other activities that were underway to eradicate smallpox. I also noted a few years ago, I read an article written by Voltaire in the 1770s, and he was talking about immunity being created by a process where a child that had the smallpox, they would take part of the smallpox pustule that grew on the arm of the child with the disease, and they would take it out and put it in a child that was healthy, and that action would protect that child. That's different than a vaccination, and that's an important thing. Immunization and vaccination are spoken of in as if they were the same thing, when in fact they are not necessarily the same thing, and they might act differently on different people. And then, as you say, when you look through the history of the smallpox situation, you'll see that from time to time governments mandate them, and then there are problems. People get sick or die or whatever happens to them, and then the mandates go away. And then another political party comes in, and they mandate it, and then they have problems, and then it goes away. And that's in this film that you mentioned that you maybe we should put a little website up on these programs right there, so when people come in and see the program or hear the program, they can also go find the stuff we're referring to. But sure. In any case, that particular story is important. It's very important to grasp real data, real important data. So let's just say, starting in 1850, that infectious diseases were a serious cause of death the world in 1850. By 1950, that had been reduced significantly, like 99%. We went from the primary killers being infectious diseases to the primary killers being chronic diseases. So that all happened, that reduction, 1850 to 1950, prior to the introduction of vaccines. You can take every single disease and show that infectious disease and show that the precipitous drop in that disease happened prior to the introduction of a vaccine against that disease, right across the board. And that should be a piece of data that's very, very important to understand, because it well may be that vaccination is useful in eliminating the last residue of a disease, targeted vaccination in smallpox, but does not play or is not necessary to play a major role in eliminating the massive influence of the disease over time. My point is to make an argument for understanding the full context of what we're dealing with. Now, the way that the COVID-19 showed up was precipitous. It was an emergency. It suddenly appeared out of nowhere, at least as far as the consciousness of the public is concerned, and we had to do extremist-type interventions. And that's how we ended up where we are. But why did that happen? From 1980 to 2021, the National Institutes of Health, National NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, put almost its entire budget into dealing with vaccines to solve health problems. So they spent an enormous amount of time trying to come up with a vaccine against AIDS. Over at the National Cancer Institute, millions and millions of dollars, maybe probably billions, went into finding a vaccine against cancer. And the vaccine idea shouldered off the agenda, the research agenda, all kinds of other ideas that other kinds of scientists had. And they didn't get funding. They weren't brought onto line. They weren't given the kind of backing and the kind of rhetorical support that developing a vaccine did. And this is a problem in decision making. I think it's more a problem in decision making than it is a problem in the actual end product of a vaccine or not a vaccine or a mask or not a mask or whatever. The problem is, how do we make decisions that allow us to recognize that that a multiplicity of responses to any one of these disease issues is available and should be nurtured so that all of them are out there, so that the ultimate end user, the consumer, the patient, the client, whatever we call them, the ultimate end user, the person who I call the consumer, is the one that ends up with the option of making choices about how to handle their own health. And then they can work with their professional healthcare provider and address a fundamental idea in the healthcare world, which is the biochemical individuality. Every individual has a biochemical profile. It's different from every other individual. It's like fingerprints. And the idea that we're going to step in and give everybody the same treatment for something that it comes along that very well may affect every individual differently and clusters of individuals differently, leads us in a direction where we have serious problems. In COVID-19, 75% of the early onset, 75% of the people getting the disease early on and also of the deaths early on had hypertension. Now, maybe there's a way of approaching people with hypertension and COVID-19 that would be different than you would approach somebody who didn't have hypertension. My point is simply that there are many. It's a much broader, more subtle task to figure out how to deal with something like COVID-19 than merely get the vaccine. But basically, all we're hearing from the authorities is get the vaccine. And it's worse than that, because they're not only saying get the vaccine, they're saying don't get anything else. And if you try to get anything else, we're going to retaliate in some way. If you talk about getting anything else, we're going to take you offline. If you try to get anything else, we're going to put a barrier in your way and tell you that you can't have it. And if you try to prescribe it, we're going to take your license away and so on. This is all political stuff that should not be happening. Whatever the story is on vaccines and COVID, people need to have choice. I mean, there are many, many non-drug interventions that are valuable to the individual's immune system, whether or not they have been vaccinated. So that there are things that could be recommended for people. And look, if you want to get vaccinated, get vaccinated. If you don't want to get vaccinated, don't get vaccinated. But while doing that, here's an array of 8 or 10 things that you might also want to consider doing. That's the way you would ordinarily think a public health problem would be handled. But in our situation, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. Everything else is secondary.
Now, in reference to that, the ramifications of that thought process, vaccinate, 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 or wear a mask or whatever, now Joe Biden is coming up with this stuff that, you know, he's tightening the screws. Federal workers have to either be fully vaccinated or be tested. You know, where is that leading us, Jim? You know, I was just reading. The screws are tightening. Go ahead.
Let me make a couple of comments about that. So, for example, Joe Biden didn't do that.
Right.
I mean, Joe Biden's the boss, and he signs the notes that are the rules. But the process created that, and we need to really understand that a whole apparatus underneath Joe Biden made that decision. Now, I will tell you, I'm talking to people who are taking the vaccines, and I'm talking to people who aren't taking the vaccines, and it's fascinating to me to listen. One of the people, a very solid friend, guy that really studies things and so forth, said, "Yeah, I took the vaccination. Why? Why did I take the vaccination? Because I'm a patriot. I have a full career in the military. I swore to this country. I swore on a Bible. I took the oath to defend this country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And now I'm adding microbial. And I went out and took the vaccine because that was the patriotic thing to do. Now, that particular individual, and I think there are many others, in fact, I've heard from others like that, but he was very articulate about it. They didn't look at the pros and cons for themselves. They didn't look at health or not health. What they said was, in order to contribute to the well-being of this country, I am going to go out and get vaccinated. And I respect that. I honor that. I think it is a perfectly reasonable course of action. I have no idea in the long run how that's going to work in solving the overall problem, but I can assure you when all the people signed up to go to war in the Second World War, they didn't know how the war was going to come out either. And so he's taken a step. It may be a risk. From one angle, it's a risk. Personally, to contribute to the total society. And I think that's very reasonable. I think that's a different discussion than when we see somebody like, you see the advisors to the FDA who are on vaccines. Every single one of them has an interest in vaccines. One of the advisors to the FDA vaccine committee himself put a vaccine on the market, made a bunch of money off the vaccine, and then the vaccine had to be withdrawn. This wasn't for COVID. It was for something else. Had to be withdrawn in the early 2000s because it was for harming children. But he's out there just drumming away for vaccines. I mean, if you walked in and said, you know, you want to lose weight, we've got a vaccine for it, he'd be for it. I mean, it's a mindset that's just mind-boggling. It's a completely different mindset than the one of the patriot who said, I'm going to take the vaccine because it's the patriotic thing to do. And I just don't, the people like that, the advisors to the FDA and the people at NIAID and the people at NIH, all these folks who are operating out of that premise have a firm belief, a firm, unshakable belief. It may or may not be right, but it's a firm, unshakable belief that vaccines are the answer. When we did our battle back in the 1970s, there were about 8 vaccines that kids took when they went to school. They now get over 70 encounters with the vaccine needle in school. And I think that's above 50 vaccines that are available. I think there are about 11 or 12 that are mandated, and they each have several encounters with them during a school career. The notion that we're going to just continuously expand, trying to defend ourselves against agents by creating counter agents, it's like trying to run the Cold War in the microbial world. There are many other ways of looking at how the body is structured, starting with the biochemical individuality, or going to something like how cell walls are organized. There are many other non-vaccine interventions that should be a part of the palette of helping us work our way through as individuals and as a society. I don't see that here. I'm just saying the Biden team is making these decisions on the top of the team that's been there for Trump. For Obama, I mean, Fauci's been there for 30 years. The people around Fauci have been there not that length, but, you know, 10, 20 years. And the system around which Fauci is a part of has been there for 100 years, roughly. And they've been there working away on this idea that vaccines are the answer, vaccines are the answer, vaccines are the answer, continuously. The evidence for vaccine being the answer is relatively thin when you start looking at it in detail. That there is a role for vaccines, yes. What that role is unclear, completely unclear, in every one of these diseases. Pertussis vaccine was the dirtiest thing put into humans, and everybody knew it, starting in 1935 all the way up to the 1990s. Then they changed it to something else that was supposed to be cleaner. It's now causing problems, and they're very worried about it. When I say they, the established authorities are very worried about it. And every single vaccine, including polio, has had a very serious controversy. The federal government lost a lawsuit back in those 70s when a woman was made quadriplegic by the Sabin polio vaccine. A couple of thousand people were paralyzed by the Salk vaccine. Now, they always say, well, we found what the problem is, we solved it, we're not going to have that problem going on any further. That's maybe or may not be true. If you go back and look at the polio situation, Sabin and Salk fought with each other to the death over which one of their vaccines was killing more people. Vaccines, not disease. Which one had the better trade-off against risk versus benefit? They were having this fight all over the scientific community. It was not very public. All we knew publicly was take the polio vaccine, take the polio vaccine. And the issue here is not there are pro-vaccine fanatics and anti-vaccine fanatics, and they're fighting with each other, and that's their problem, and they should be put over on an island and fight. The rest of us, which I think is the vast majority of people, are trying to figure out when is the right time to use a vaccine and when isn't it. And we use different tools. Like I say, the patriotic veteran said, I'm taking it because I swore to fight enemies against my country, and they're telling me this is an enemy, and I'm going to fight it by taking the vaccine. Other people are saying, wait a minute, it's going to help the country more if I don't take the vaccine. That's what a democracy is all about, sorting out those kinds of differences. It's not about somebody at the top of the heap shooting a bolt of lightning out of their fingers and saying, do what I tell you. And the government knows that. The government's facing a serious problem with regard to vaccines because 50% of the public right now is resisting. And that, by the way, is roughly the same amount that had to do with fluoridating water. It's the same amount that had to do with almost every other one of the so-called public health benefits. Big, huge split in the country, systematically. To argue that they're right-wing and left-wing is just a phenomenon of the media. That's what they, if you're on this side, you're right. If you're on this side, you're left. And it changes back and forth. In the 50s, if you were a red guy, you were on the left, and you were vicious and nasty and destroying the country. Now, if you're a red guy, you're on the right, and you're a vicious and nasty guy destroying the country. These are memes that exist in the minds of the mind of the media of the public, and then they announce it, and people start to try to line up with it. That does not that fact that that debate is going on in the society does not relieve the intellectual leadership, the knowledge leadership, from seriously looking at the issues that need to be looked at. I mean, a year ago, if you said COVID-19 escaped from the Wuhan lab, which was in part funded by the United States government, you were kicked off social media, you were made a pariah, and so forth. Then the former head of CDC said, well, I can't rule it out, and pretty soon we now have an official investigation going into it and a whole bunch of stuff going on that a year ago you would have been pilloried for having said. And that's true on every one of the debates going on in this vaccine world. I think it's very important for us to understand that that's going on underneath all of this. And when Biden says, I want everybody to do it, recognize that's the speaking of the established order in the vaccine world, and also recognize that the union is opposing it.
Great stuff. So I'm always trying to figure stuff out, and I know we're going to be wrapping this up in a second, so I'll just ask for a little bit of a comment on your part. And I'll introduce something you may not be familiar with. I do a lot of surfing on the Internet. I'm doing a lot of research. There's always suggested videos on the right-hand side of my screen if I'm looking at YouTube. And one night, it was super late at night, there was a reaction video, and I don't know if you've ever heard of the term reaction video, but there was a reaction video from a gal to a song that was on a Pink Floyd album. So I grew up when Pink Floyd was doing stuff like Dark Side of the Moon. And there was a song called The Great Gig in the Sky, and the woman's voice was just amazing. And I said, it just caught my attention. And I said, "What? First of all, what's a reaction video? I didn't know what that was. And the second thing was, Great Gig in the Sky, well, it's, I don't know, 2:30, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I was winding down, so I said, I'll play it on one of my computer screens and I'll watch. And I got a chance to watch what a reaction video was, and I'm giving you a long, winding story, but a reaction video was a young gal who had never seen or heard that song before, and she was a younger person, not like an older person like me. So this is the first time she ever heard the voice of Great Gig in the Sky. And I'm like, wow, that was really just amazing to watch her reaction. She filmed it, and you could see her tearing up, and you could see her emotions going up and down as the music is going up and down. And there's a whole genre, if you will, of what they call reaction videos. The younger generation listening to older music for the very first time that is recommended by different people. So the only reason why I mention that is because I wonder if these people that are so blinded and so focused on their views have ever seen the movie that we're talking about a little bit earlier, Jim, with this long list of vaccination challenges. I wonder how many doctors or how many researchers today have actually sat in front of one of those things for 2 hours straight that would basically question their very beliefs and to see if they have ever done that before. And I'm going to guess there's a pretty big portion of them that would initially resist and probably turn it off because they couldn't deal with it. Or it would question their whole being and they would have to really, it would just blow their mind, almost as if the foundation of their knowledge has been blown away forever. And I'm sure there's even a bigger portion of that that would just turn it off, dismiss it as being kooky, and just psychologically banish that from even being a possibility because it would destroy their belief system. So do you think, so here's my winding story. Do you think that any of these people that are so blinded even know the history of these things that they're making rulings on today, whether it's a politician or a doctor or a social media rambler or a celebrity? Do you think they really have ever studied the downside of their arguments?
Well, I think that the issue that you're focusing on, it's one of the places I have been focusing my energy for the last 50 years, and that is that the people you're talking about who are blinded and don't look at the history of things and are caught up in their own already preconceived notion, and on any given issue that's divided in half, half of them are on one side of that issue and half are on the other side. I think that that particular group of people is a minority, a very significant, a minority, a small minority. Just take, for example, the American Medical Association. There are no more than 15% of the MDs in the United States belong to the American Medical Association, but it has about 95% of the power in determining who gets reimbursed on visits to the doctor. So they have an enormous control over the medical system. I don't believe that 10 or 15%, I don't think any of them in that group has seriously looked at any of the history you're talking about. I base that primarily on talking to some of them and listening to them and watching what they say and do. Now, that's comparable in almost every area that we are in. And across, we have, my partner, Lori Chickering, and I put out a website called the Transpartisan Review. And we talk about the fact that 30% of Americans identify with either Republican or Democratic Party politics. 30%, 70% do not identify. This is, 70% of the constitutionally eligible voters of this country do not identify with either the Republican or Democratic Party. And yet the duality of Republican and Democratic political party holders, the members, control roughly 99.9% of all of the elected jobs in the country. So that basically what you have is a very small minority controlling all of the formal power. And that's true with the AMA in the healthcare world. I mean, healthcare is about a fifth to a sixth of the economy. And the AMA, which has about 15% of the MDs, and there are only about 600,000 MDs in the country, control the healthcare system. And the result of that, when I say they control the healthcare system, what I mean is that the entry point to the healthcare system is through the pays for the doctor visits, and who pays for the doctor visits is basically decided by the AMA. You can look at other areas, and you'll find very similar kinds of control mechanisms that cause the vast majority of people to become the fodder of the very small minority that controls that system. If you look at the criminal justice system, about probably 98% of all criminal cases are settled by a negotiation with the prosecutor. Prosecutors are a relatively small part of the society in terms of numbers, but they wield this enormous power. And in fact, one of the most important legal scholars on American democracy says prosecutorial discretion is the weakness of the American democratic system. And when the FDA goes out there and decides who it's going to prosecute, that's prosecutorial discretion. And so when they're continuously putting out all kinds of messages about how bad anything that's not a drug, surgery, or radiation intervention is, while opioids are just running rampant all over the country, you can see that their decisions on who to prosecute have shaped the lives of millions of people. And yet it's a tiny, tiny little group of people who we don't have, as democratic citizens, we have no control over. And that's true that there are 50 regulatory agencies like that. So you go into looking at airplanes, and there's this tiny group of regulators on airplanes, which has been thoroughly integrated with the Boeing company, and made decisions that allowed planes to be flying that were not safe, and they ended up crashing and killing a bunch of people, two of them. And others crashed that were cargo planes for the same reasons. And they were ultimately grounded for a number of years and a couple years, and then they were put back in the air. Now, again, a very small number of people were involved in that and included the people who make the airplanes. What I'm saying is across the board, the vast majority of Americans have positions that are quite out of sync with the very narrow decision-making that's being done by the regulatory elite or the regulated elite. And that elite has interests that cause them to make decisions that do not take into account the well-being of the individuals that are involved in their world. So, you know, if a plane crashes, it's the worst thing about a plane crashing is it's a bad headline. If you get that headline off the front page quick enough, then you can get back to business and keep flying your airplane. Same thing with the vaccines, and the same thing with the opioids and so forth. So we just need to understand that when you see these doctors that don't listen to tapes that explain to them that the history of smallpox is not, we had a disease, we got a vaccine, got rid of it. That's not the history at all. But they don't care. I mean, they're not interested, that small group, and they control everything. Many doctors are out there raising these questions, many doctors, and they're silenced, and they're marginalized, and they're taken off the Internet and so on. So that we need to get our culture back in balance so that we can have the debates that we need in order to prepare for what's going to happen in the future. I mean, we're just entering this situation that we're facing with COVID-19. We're just at the beginning of this. It's going to go on and on and on. So, anyway.
Yeah, great information. Fantastic information. For those people listening in, I mean, I listen to what you say, Jim, and I have to re-listen to what you say because there's a wealth of information, and the words you're using, even though you're using everyday regular words, the depth of what you're saying is huge. So for those people listening in, you want to check them out again. If you go to buildingfortressradio.com/citizens, listen to any one of the previous radio shows, share with your people. It's easy enough to do, and obviously listen in whenever we do these things live. But, Jim, you're great information. I appreciate the time that you're able to give me and our Building Fortunes Radio listening audience and the research that I do during the week preparing for this. has helped me out a lot. So in those regards, it's just been an incredible adventure and a journey and a great understanding of some of the things that we're studying live, literally, as it's happening right now. And I don't know where it's going. And there's some real winners and some real losers. And we didn't touch on this at all on this radio show, but maybe we could touch on it next week. And it may not be even a part of the Citizens for Health topics, but there's a big issue that's going to be going on right now. As a matter of fact, I think even today with the evictions delays, where unless the government pulls out another rabbit from a hat and kicks the can down the road again, there could be millions of Americans evicted as a result of the decisions that were made based on these medical doctors or these medical people on shutting down businesses. So it's somewhat related but unrelated, but maybe we could talk a little bit about that next week as well.
Just let me just say for the record that evictions is a huge public health problem. The notion of being evicted and threatening to be evicted and facing eviction spreads health problems like crazy. And it's really important to know that that's a really bad idea from the standpoint of public policy to just start evicting people. It doesn't make any sense at all in any kind of cost-benefit analysis, any kind of well-being for the culture and the society at large. Forget the individual people that are involved. And, of course, it's a disaster for them. We should get into that next week. That'd be a great topic.
Perfect, because next week we'll find out what they did, meaning did they kick it down the road or are the people actually literally having some serious challenges with now finding places to move. So we're going to be back next week on Building Fortunes Radio. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And hold on one second. I've been talking so much, I pulled up the wrong exit music. So let me go pull up the right exit music, and we will catch everybody next time on Building Fortunes Radio. Thanks, everyone.
All right,
thanks, Jim.
Talk to you next week.
Catch you later. Thank you. Okay, bye.
Thanks, bye.
I will find our exit music. There we go.
You've been listening to the Citizens for Health radio show, brought to you by Citizens for Health on buildingfortunesradio.com with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Thanks for listening. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. Go to www.citizens.org to learn more and always listen in to Building Fortunes Radio, where our special host, Jim Turner, shares crucial information about many of the most important issues that affect your world. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. So listen in, get involved, and help spread the word. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website to hear more Citizens for Health segments with Jim Turner and Peter Mingle. And read about what's new on www.citizens.org. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. Jim Turner, Peter, and I want to say thanks for listening and ask you to go spread the word. Tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.